Welcome to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. We study change in order to make change, linking knowledge of the past to the quest for a better future. Every other week, we examine the most pressing issues of the day through a historical lens, helping us understand what happened then and what that means for us now.
Hello, I'm David Myers, your host of Then and Now, which is sponsored by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. The Hamas massacre of October 7th and the devastating Israeli military response in Gaza have not only shocked the world, but repositioned the fate of Israel and Palestine at the center of international attention. The events of the last 3 months represent a terrifying new phase in the long century of tensions between Jews and Arabs in the region. How did we get to this point, and where might we be headed? To answer these questions, we turn to Aaron David Miller, renowned commentator, author, historian, and one of the most experienced State Department officials dealing with the Middle East over the course of his career from 1978 to 2003. We want to understand from him how he sees the Israeli military campaign, what Hamas and its leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, hope for, and what the place of United States diplomacy in the current moment is. Few can offer as wide-ranging and critical a perspective on the history of U.S. policy in the Middle East as Aaron David Miller, and we're fortunate to have him on Then and Now.
David, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we're almost 3 months from the October 7th massacre, which prompted the massive Israeli response in Gaza. Where are we at today, Aaron? How do you see the current state of affairs?
I think we're still in a long, dark tunnel. I've witnessed and participated in and around any number of Israeli-Lebanese, Israeli-Palestinian crises over the last several decades, but none has brought the degree of complexity and uncertainty as this one has. We know very little about the condition of the hostages. We know almost nothing on the granular level of how the Israelis are operating in Gaza since there's very little embedding, and what embedding is done under tightly IDF supervision. We know nothing about the negotiations leading to the release of hostages during the first humanitarian pause. And frankly, with all the ink spilled over the day after and the day after the day after, we know very little about what separates reality from fantasy on what's going to happen in 2024. Right now, I would assess matters as follows. You have two active fronts, actually three active fronts. Israel's operating in Gaza. Their objectives have been the same since the beginning: destroy, eradicate, degrade, and I realize there are different interpretations of what those words mean. Hamas's military infrastructure above and below ground, number one. Number two, kill its senior leadership. And number three, redeem the hostages. The fourth goal is to end Hamas's sovereignty in Gaza. It's to say its capacity to actually govern there. How are the Israelis doing on this? I think what appears to be, and I think what will continue to be a kind of imminent readjustment of their own military tactics suggests that it's a much more complicated and heavy lift than they believed.
So how do you think that adjustment might take place? I guess this goes back to the question, how achievable were those declared goals that you just articulated a minute ago? So how achievable are they, and then what might that adjustment look like? I mean, it's a matter of if the Israelis kill Sinwar, is that the beginning of the exit strategy?
Well, I was going to say, number one, they're not going to eliminate anywhere from 15 to 30,000 Hamas fighters. They're not going to purge Hamas as an idea in Gaza politics. Right now, they've done tremendous damage, particularly in northern Gaza. This is not a body bag count. If it turns into one, then there surely will be a pyrrhic victory. Maybe they've killed. I mean, the Palestinian Ministry of Health, Hamas-controlled, reports 22,000 Palestinians dead. Factor in, and they do not separate between combatants and non-combatants. So maybe 7,000-8,000 Hamas fighters dead. Senior leadership, Marwan Issa, Yahya Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, are still ensconced, maybe in Khan Yunis. And the Israelis can't seem to identify, let alone kill or capture them. The fate of the hostages. And I think here Israel is torn between a commitment to the dead, the 12 to 1300 Israelis who were massacred in that 24-hour period and their commitment to redeem the living. It's a very cruel sort of bind that they're in. But I saw a recent figure quoted by the prime minister's office, 129 hostages, they believe, 20 plus were either murdered in Gaza, their bodies taken to Gaza, or they died as a consequence of serendipity or willfully murdered by Hamas. So you're talking about 100 hostages. I think on that score, the Israelis are no closer right now, given what happened in Beirut yesterday with the assassination of Salah Hariri. I think hostages have become ever more valuable to Sinwar, who I think wants to trade them ultimately, not just for Palestinian prisoners, but for a cessation of hostilities, a ceasefire, which enables Hamas to survive. So I think the Israelis understand that keeping 360,000 reserves mobilized is having a bad impact on morale and on the Israeli economy, and the Biden administration is pressing for them to change their operations from division size operations throughout the entire Gaza Strip, heavy on artillery and airstrikes, to a more brigade size operational intelligence driven set of tactics, which would allow, and this is the, I think, the key issue, which would allow an environment in which you could surge humanitarian assistance reliably, predictably, in large amounts into, particularly into southern Gaza. Because right now, you can't possibly get in what Gaza needs. The Israelis, for example, ban any delivery to a commercial enterprise or a business because of fear of its being diverted. So that certainly would have to end if Gaza is going to breathe again. So that, I think, is what's coming. I think we'll know by the end of January whether this is smoke or whether the Israelis really are adjusting those tactics.
So, Aaron, how do you assess the Israeli military response? By which I really mean, if you were in charge, what would you have done after the massacre of October 7th? There's been a lot of ink spilled on that very question. There's been a huge amount of criticism directed at the Israeli military operation. How do you assess it? And, you know, can you imagine, from your perspective, as someone deeply involved in U.S. policy in the Middle East, alternative and better options?
You know, in a galaxy far, far away, but not tethered to reality back here on planet Earth, or let's just say on planet Israel, an enlightened government which had its eye on the past and the future might have said to itself, you know, there's a reason we did not launch a massive operation in Gaza since 2007, because we cannot eradicate an idea. That idea is objectionable. It's let's replace Israel with an Islamic State. But you can't eradicate that idea. We're going to spend a lot of our own lives and thousands of Palestinian lives trying to eradicate Hamas proper. So we will take the high ground, and we will benefit from the tremendous support we're going to get from the entire international community, who will applaud us for understanding given what's been done to us, we are not going to we're not going to take innocent Palestinian lives, and we will confine ourselves to a long-term strategy of eliminating Hamas's leadership. And of course, undercutting Hamas by pursuing a political horizon that will deal with the absence of security and prosperity and show the world and to Palestinians in Gaza what a horrible, terrible organization Hamas really is. All right. That's what I would argue would be a strategy for a galaxy far, far away. Given the trauma of October 7th, the galactic failure, both of intelligence and operational failure, the fact that it took anywhere as long as 12 to 18 hours to redeem those Gaza civilians in the Gaza envelope and those villages and kibbutzim and border communities. G- given the nature of this Israeli government, given the sense of anger and guilt that must have pervaded the intelligence, security, IDF, and the political establishment, given who the prime minister of Israel is, a man who's now conflated his own personal survival with the best interests of the state of Israel, what he conceives to be the best interest state of Israel. Was there a plan B along the lines I described? It's almost unthinkable. I mean, I look back on, and the president made a point of trying to gently press the Israelis to consider the 9/11 precedent. But look what we did in the wake of 9/11. We ended up in the two longest wars in American history. We ended up killing, by conservative estimates, hundreds of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis, combatants and non-combatants. And we didn't have a proximity problem with Al-Qaeda. This was not Israel's 9/11 because of that proximity problem. So, I mean, as much as you and I, David, could have predicted the parade of horrors that the Israelis have caused in Gaza as a consequence of the military challenge. How do you eradicate an organization that embeds itself in and around and under, and frankly doesn't care how many Palestinians are killed, and may in fact serve the grievance victimization narrative that they wanted to create? I stand sort of paralyzed now in thinking about this. So I don't, and you know, again, the administration, if the Israelis were looking for a green light, all they had to do was look to October 10th and the president's powerful emotional speech, in which he said, I think, if this had happened to us, we would respond with swiftness, decisiveness, and swift and decisive, he said, swift and decisive. Now, the Israelis took 3 weeks before they mounted a ground campaign, but between October 7 and October 27, they wreaked upon Gaza the most punishing airstrikes, some experts say, of the 21st century, in terms of targets hit and the nature of ordnance dropped. So it's I'm paralyzed on this one.
And we should just add that on October 7th, just in thinking of motivations, Prime Minister Netanyahu vowed that Israel would act with mighty vengeance. And I think you're absolutely right to call attention to the trauma, to the rage, and really the shame.
You put it better than I, David. It's the rage and the shame. I think that's that. You know, the Israelis don't talk about vengeance, although every now and then there's a slipped word about flattening Gaza or wreaking that kind of havoc. But again, I think it had to be rage of a kind that was sort of intimately felt given the character of the killing.
So, Aaron, this podcast Then and Now seeks to use history to understand how we got where we are. So I want to ask you, how did we get to this point? When you think of the layers of history that enveloped October 7th and the aftermath, what is most prominent in your mind?
Well, you know, I've thought about this, you know, in terms of causality. You know, and there's two ways to look at this. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict didn't begin on October 7th, right? So that takes you back through a torturous thread of it, just an exhausting, interminable process of efforts by one party or another, half-hearted, some serious, some not serious, intermittent violence, terror, confrontation. And I mean, where I've drawn the line, and I'm willing to accept the fact that October 7 did not occur in a vacuum, but had October 7 been launched by a party, a Palestinian party that had participated in this sort of long thread of semi-successes, largely failures, and was bred by a frustration, heartfelt because of the absence of security, the absence of prosperity, the occupation, the policies of the most extremist right-wing government in Israel's history, at least over the last year. And had the operation been designed to strike at military targets, in order essentially, I can't really compare it to Sadat's strategy in 73, inflict a limited military victory for Egypt and a defeat on Israel in order to get the Americans involved, because I, Anwar Sadat, had in the back of my mind, I could get Sinai back if I got the Americans involved and created urgency in Israel's mind. Then I could see causality. But given the fact that this operation was planned in a year by a group, by an organization, even if you believe that there was an alternative path for Hamas to take, and somewhere in the mid-aughts, certainly in 2021 when Abbas canceled elections, any political strategy Hamas entailed to take over the PLO and to make itself the centerpiece of the Palestinian National Movement, which is its objective. Its objective is not to negotiate or to even inflict a limited military defeat on Israel in an effort to negotiate. It's a long-term strategy, a sort of, you know, I guess millennial strategy in a way, designed here we get to the design to do what? And I do we know what was in the mind of Sinwar and Mohammed Deif in terms of what they thought they were doing with this operation? I mean, we really don't. We can use confirmation bias to work backwards and to take a look at what Hamas did on October 7th and what they thought might happen or would happen. So I guess that what I'm trying to say is Hamas's as much as Hamas thought of itself as a part of the Palestinian National Movement, it was not a movement that sought to figure out a way to negotiate with Israel based on a two-state solution. It was designed politically to essentially weaken Abbas, to undermine its authority in the West Bank, and ultimately to emerge as the central agent, not in the redemption of Palestine, but with a time frame that would stretch long beyond you. The two of us were here on planet Earth. So October 7th became something else. It was an operation designed, I think, to break out of a strategy that Hamas believed was leading it into a dead end. There would be no elections. Abbas canceled them. Governance of Gaza, content with their little state, was in many respects living on the edge, dependent on Qatari money and Israeli acquiescence, flow of workers. At the time of shortly before the attack, the Israelis and Hamas were negotiating through cutouts to increase the number of Palestinian workers in Israel proper. So a year or so ago, perhaps longer, Hamas, Sinwar, I think, developed another strategy, which was this breakout strategy designed to inflict the maximum amount of pain and degradation and humiliation on Israel as possible. In the hopes of what? In the hopes that the regional anger and rage would become so great that protests would develop in every part of the Arab world, that Iran and Hezbollah and the so-called axis of resistance, including the Houthis, would join the struggle, and you'd end up with a provocation that led to some, I don't know, regional escalation that would somehow alter the current reality? Because otherwise, I don't know how Hamas calculated this?
Well, let me just suggest what it might have looked like. They might have anticipated pretty much what happened, which is that Israel would fall into a trap, as our friend Hussein Ibish said, I think, on October 12th, undertake a very lengthy and deadly military assault, which would completely shift international sympathy from Israel after October 7th to the Palestinian cause, and at the same time, make Hamas heroic in the eyes of Palestinians in the Arab world for precisely that breakout, for shattering the paradigm. And in that regard, on those two grounds, both the image of Israel in the international realm and Hamas's assumption of leadership in advancing the Palestinian cause, which had been in a state of torpor, you could argue that from their perspective, the operation was a great success.
Well, I mean, we've entered the third month, and I'm wondering whether Hamas's strategic calculations will prove to be Pyrrhic. And I might add, Israel's calculations may prove to be Pyrrhic as well. Hamas, I don't think, although you'd have to believe that Sinwar, having served 20 years in Israeli prison and with fluency in Hebrew, must have understood what the kind of killing Hamas perpetrated in that 24-hour period would have created a massive Israeli response in Gaza. But that response has now, despite the trap that the Israelis appear to be in, may well ultimately conclude with the end of Hamas's sovereignty in Gaza, and perhaps over time, the end of its leadership. Nothing concentrates the mind as profoundly as a drone strike. And Israel's been down this road before. Ronen Bar, the head of Shin Bet, in November said, "This is our Munich. And it may take weeks, months, or years, but we will get them all." And the Israelis got most of the Munich perpetrators. It took time. So this may be an existential moment, and the sort of, I don't know how to describe it, end of days, end of time scenario that Sinwar envisioned, may not include Hamas or Sinwar as an active proponent. Now, maybe they're simply thinking, maybe this was an end of days strategy for Sinwar. The mythology, the narrative of the struggle, the sacrifice of the Shaheed, all of this stuff is going to reverberate for years in Palestinian society. I think Hamas underestimated several things, though. Number one, that Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran were prepared to fight Israel to the last Palestinian. We're now in the third month of this war, and I think the risk aversion that Iran and Hezbollah that has governed their behavior in the north still prevails. That could change, but I think it still prevails, number one. I think Hamas underestimated the preternatural support from the Biden administration, number two. And I'm not sure about the end of times sort of narrative in terms of the region. The region has a way of absorbing over decades now the sort of pain and suffering of various conflicts, whether it's Iraq, Syria, Yemen. And this is another chapter. And while the Arab world has clearly made the price of their admission for reconstruction of Gaza and participation in supporting that reconstruction, the creation of a political horizon and a two-state solution, I still am stunned by the deafening silence from the Gulf with respect. I would never have believed that Israel could cause the deaths of 22,000 Palestinians without a fundamental fracturing of its treaty relationships with Israel and Jordan and its Abraham Accords relations with the Bahrainis, with the Emiratis, and much to my, I should not be surprised, MBS's, Mohammed bin Salman, and Saudi Arabia's, his commitment still, and I'm not speculating here, that when the conflict reaches a much lower intensity phase, that he may well want to pick up where the Biden administration left off with 50, 60, 70% of the issues in the U.S.-Saudi relationship to make an Israeli-Saudi normalization agreement possible, probably already worked out.
So I want to go back to that because it is assumed by many that one of the motives for Hamas was precisely to derail the Saudi-Israeli normalization talks. And that helps us understand, that's one of the sort of contextual circles in which we should embed October 7th, along with the perception that the Palestinian issue had been marginalized and sort of removed from the stage of diplomatic concern. And we might add to that the weakened position of, and the highly compromised position of Prime Minister Netanyahu. So in light of those factors, it seems to me you think it's possible, from what you're seeing and hearing, that that attempt to derail may not have been successful. And the silence of the Gulf states about the scale of destruction in Gaza, to you, points to the prospect of revived negotiations on Saudi-Israeli normalization.
I do, and I'm thinking, you know, I divide time now into two sort of increments when it comes to U.S. policy. Phase one is between now and November 2024. That, in my judgment, will be the year of Gaza. Should Biden be reelected, and paradoxically, even if he's not reelected, and the presumptive Republican nominee reenters the White House, MBS's calculation may still be the same. Now, that would suggest some sort of political transition in Israel. But November 24 going forward could coincide with leadership changes, at least on the Israeli side, that could make what is now impossible, both in terms of an Israeli-Saudi deal and I know I'm on really shaky ground here, creating a better pathway forward for Israelis and Palestinians. That is a 2024 issue if Joe Biden is elected. If Trump regains the White House, assuming this issue is of any relevance or importance to him at all, I think that prospects for any sort of Israeli-Palestinian deal will fade. And that raises the whole question of would Mohammed bin Salman in a Trump administration, with the sort of contempt and opposition he's shown toward anything remotely associated with Palestinians, would MBS be able to continue to operate with the Trump administration and with whatever government in Israel emerged? I think it's an interesting question, but we really are into the area of thought experiments here. 2024 will be the year of Gaza, and I have very low expectations of what that year is going to bring. Reality number one, Israel will be operating in Gaza at some level and in some way for months to come, either by creating its own sort of buffer zone. And the Israelis will clearly want to have some involvement in what comes into Gaza if, in fact, there are residual Hamas elements that are benefiting from it. Dual-use items that are used for reconstruction. I can't imagine the Israelis will simply say, well, whatever you want to import, import. That's reality number one. Number two is the Palestinian Authority. there's no doubt that Palestinians governing Gaza is in fact the only solution to this. How quickly, how efficiently it will be possible to create a revitalized Palestinian Authority, it seems almost mythical and fantastical to me right now. It's hard to imagine that Mahmoud Abbas in the 18th or 19th year of his four-year term, given his credibility problems, the surge of Hamas's support, if you believe Khalil Shakaki's polls, and I do, has tripled in the West Bank. The armed groups of young men, the Nablus Brigade, Sons of Jenin, they've been given a huge boost as a consequence of growing settler vigilantism and what is now routine IDF raids into Gaza, and to the policies of the annexationist ministers, which continue to push Palestinians off of their land, whole shepherding communities, as many as 1,000 plus. That's a very tough environment to think about reconstituting a new set of Palestinian security services and transplanting them to Gaza quickly. I would think that would require, that sort of transition requires two things: new leadership on the Palestinian side that's more credible, and new leadership on the Israeli side. Because how do you revitalize the PAA and hope that it somehow can be transferred governance to Gaza while you undermine the Palestinian authorities through your annexationist policies in the West Bank? It just doesn't compute. And then you need a legitimizing agent. And that legitimizing agent has to be, however messy and complicated, it has to be elections.
So I want to take a step back because you've just given us a lot to think about and actually call upon you not just as a seasoned commentator or an exceptionally experienced U.S. Policy official, but as an historian, to reflect on what seems like a very banal question. But I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. What do you think the importance of leadership is in this situation, this conflict? How do you assess the impact of actual individuals to have a substantial influence and maybe even redirect the course of history? Or are we really thinking about deep structures that are in some sense immune to the actions of individuals?
I mean, not surprisingly, David, you've put your finger on the key. I don't want to be accused of being a reductionist by claiming that, you know, great men and women make history. But the reality is my experience in the Arab-Israeli issue, the structural factors are hugely important. They constrain great leaders. But in order to get the process moving, you need humans who are masters of their political houses, not prisoners of their ideologies. You know, I think Marx wrote, and forgive me, in the 19th century, men make history, but rarely as they please. All right. So it's the interaction between human agency and circumstance that basically defines and reflects, in my judgment, and let's confine this just to the Arab-Israeli issue. Let's not talk about Putin or Zelensky. Zelensky is an example of where does leadership come from? And it's impressive. You know, I'll go reductionist on you and say that of the four factors that I have long argued are necessary to be in place to have a fighting chance to end the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I will say to you now, I still believe that is possible. But to make that possible, you need to give me the first element, which we do not have, and the prospect of having leaders who are masters of these political houses, not prisoners of their ideologies, willing for their own reasons, not as a consequence of external pressure, to exhibit ownership. The line that Larry Summers and Tom Friedman are still fighting over who coined it: in the history of the world, nobody ever washed a rental car. People don't wash rental cars usually although I use this line all the time, and invariably I will get a note weeks later which contains a receipt from a car wash place. So, but most normal human beings don't wash their rental cars because people care only about what they own. So you need leaders who are willing to protect their negotiations for their own reasons, not because France or the UN or the US tells them to do so, but because they think it's right. And that is why every breakthrough, Israel, Egypt, Israel, Jordan, Israel, Palestine, all came without the presence of the United States. It was only after Sadat shows up in Washington in October 77 and informs my predecessors at the State Department that he had been meeting secretly with Sadat's vice president. That's why I'm on leave in the west coast of Florida in August of 1993, and the State Department Operations Center calls and says, well, you better come back soon. The secretary's going to California. We knew there was an Oslo channel. We had no idea that it was the decision-making channel. And the Israeli and Jordanians have been negotiating secretly before the State of Israel was even created. So that is what you need, and that is what we have not had. And again, I'm at a loss here because you don't just need managers. You need a Mandela and a de Klerk. You need a special kind of human. I mean, because it is an existential, not just politically, it's an existential issue. I mean, Rabin played with his life, and so did Sadat, for what they did. And I remember thinking, with the one or two meetings Arafat and Barak had at Camp David, you know, I don't know what Barak was thinking. Arafat actually said, I heard him say four or five times, that I'm not going to make decisions that will allow you, the Americans, to walk behind my coffin. I won't do that. So that's what you need on the Israeli and Palestinian side, and you need a commitment in Washington.
You need leaders who are prepared to die for the cause?
No one undertakes a mission, perhaps except if you're in the military and you're most of your days are spent putting yourself in harm's way with that sort of mentality. But you need people who are selfless and willing to sacrifice, who understand their own personal demons and are willing to put them aside in the interests of something bigger than themselves. You know, leaders who are prepared to turn the M in me upside down, so it becomes a W in we. That's what you need. Now, you know, there are no rewind buttons on history, but I made this point to you before. It is my view that had Rabin not been murdered and Bush 41 not lost to Bill Clinton, that the combination of Bush, Baker, and Rabin could have produced one agreement either between Israel and the Palestinians or Israel and Syria. And had that happened in the mid to late 90s, you and I might be having a different kind of conversation today. There are many, I should add, who think that I'm 100% wrong and that the structural forces quickly assert themselves and overwhelm in one way or another, you know, the greats.
Your book would include Sadat and Rabin.
Yes.
Anyone else?
Oh, I would put King Hussein in that basket. No one believed that he would be the second Arab head of state to sign a full treaty of peace with Israel. And what made that possible was that Arafat took him off the hook. Arafat's deal with the Israelis, Arafat in his first incarnation, even Rabin acknowledged that Arafat had made tough and very difficult choices. But Arafat could not. I mean, my bottom line on Arafat was he was a prod. It's like giving a student an exam he could not possibly pass by testing that student on material that he had never encountered before. Arafat's life, his essence, his persona, lived in a different world. And the expectation, I now see looking back on this, the last time officially I saw Arafat was with Tony Zinni in March of 2002 when the Israelis had him surrounded in his mukata. We entered the darkened mukata where we had seen Arafat scores of times in the past. The doors were blockaded with huge mattresses. The windows were blocked. There were no working lavatories. The stench was overwhelming. And we walked up to Arafat's conference room. We walked in. Windows are blacked out. He's sitting there at the end of a long, darkened table with his advisors flanking him on either side. And the only light in the room is candlelight. And Zinni and I walk in, and there is Arafat in his element with his black foreboding machine pistol sitting right on top of the table, talking to Zinni and I about martyrdom and the importance, if necessary, of dying for the cause of Philistine. And, that's who he was. And he took a huge leap in Oslo, but it was to be, I think, the last concession that he was prepared to make. And again, not putting it all on Arafat. Camp David, the urban legend of what happened at Camp David several of my colleagues have tried to correct the record on this. Arafat's transgression was not that he didn't sign here, because no Palestinian leader could have signed up to what Barak, however heroic he was, and he was heroic, was pushing. Arafat's transgression was not to understand that there was still a possibility between July and the end of the Clinton administration, 5-6 months later, for an agreement, not to take seriously empowering his aides who were willing to, I think, put alternatives and counterproposals on the table that might have led to such a negotiation.
I want to step back from the question, the eternal question, Arafat Barak, who's responsible, to draw on something that is completely and squarely in your wheelhouse, which is the role of the United States in navigating these very troubled waters. You served under 6 secretaries of state. You have as good a perspective on the way in which U.S. policy on Israel-Palestine has unfolded over the last half century or so. How would you grade U.S. diplomacy on Israel-Palestine over the course of your career? What have been the high points and the low points? Who stood out and who stood out for particular commendation, and who deserves a measure of opprobrium?
I think to answer that question, there's a more foundational question, and that is, how does the U.S. comport itself when it comes to Arab-Israeli negotiations and its relationship with Israel? That is the key. And I would give you several examples of successes in Arab-Israeli diplomacy. And most of them have one thing in common. I coined a term in 2005 in a Washington op-ed piece. And I borrowed a phrase out of Kissinger's memoirs. It was the notion of not becoming Israel's lawyer. And Kissinger referenced that. He did not want to become Israel's lawyer. And frankly, by and large, he was to some degree, but he was also able to create an independence of decision-making backed up by Nixon and then by Ford, which brought 3 disengagement agreements in 18 months and paved the way for an Israeli-Egyptian peace process that would later evolve. We far too often, let me say this. We are not an objective observer or negotiator or mediator when it comes to the Arab-Israeli issue. this is a good place to start. There are times when we can be effective brokers. Kissinger was an effective broker, 3 disengagement agreements in 18 months. Carter was a very effective broker in both the Camp David summit of September 78 and his risk readiness to take a trip in early 79 to hammer out the final details of an Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. There, Carter was able to balance America's role as a negotiating party, to find the right balance between Egyptian needs and requirements and Israeli needs and requirements. We played that role effectively. However much Carter, in many people's minds, wandered off the highway after he became president with respect to his affinity and empathy for the Palestinians and not for the Israelis, he was an extraordinary negotiator. We controlled the text of Camp David 1. It went through 20-plus drafts. That was not the case in Camp David 2.
So Carter deserves commendation.
Absolutely. And any Israeli or Egyptian associated with those days, and remember, it was not a labor government that made that deal, right? It was the political earthquake, the government of the political earthquake, 4 years after the October War, the rise of Menachem Begin and Likud. Okay, so we were an effective broker in that regard. We were an effective broker, in my judgment, during the Bush-Baker years, even though it was largely a procedural breakthrough on the way to Madrid. Baker showed the resident toughness and independence of decision-making, particularly to battle back against the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Jewish community here, and Congress on the issue of housing loan guarantees. Because every time we showed up in Israel, Shamir seemed to have announced a new housing project or settlement. That was effective diplomacy. And our negotiations between Israel and Syria, which never came to fruition during the Clinton years, I think we were actually capable of being an effective broker then as well. When it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, we have not and never have been what I would call, forget honest brokers. I've retired that term a long time ago. Because the nature of our relationship with Israel, a special relationship which can be used and deployed in our advantage, sometimes becomes exclusive. And when it becomes exclusive, when we cannot see that Israeli and Palestinian needs and requirements need to be reconciled, and in reconciling them, that leads to moments of considerable tension and awkwardness, and maybe serious tensions between the United States and Israel, we have always, I'm trying to think of an example. There have been moments, Clinton frustrated with Barack. You made me feel like a wooden Indian in my negotiations with Assad in the Syrians. There have been moments of frustration. Barack Obama being lectured by Benjamin Netanyahu.
Wouldn't your mentor, James Baker's F the Jews, qualify?
Although Baker assured us, his Jewish advisors, that he never said that. The deployment of expletives on part of several of my former bosses at moments of frustration and great exasperation were legendary, including Bill Clinton after his first meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu in 1996, walks out and says, "Who's the effing superpower here?" So frustrated as he was with Netanyahu's arrogance. So I think there have been moments, but we've never really looked at Israeli and Palestinian needs and requirements as somehow symmetries that needed to be, we needed to find the critical balance point in the middle. Now, maybe that's always elusive, but I don't think we've ever really put it to the test. Baker and Bush probably would have, had they turned their efforts to an Israeli-Palestinian deal. In the Clinton administration, and I don't doubt Bill Clinton's intentions. I know he was very offended with the article that I wrote on Israel's lawyer, but I put myself at the top of the list and said, I know a lawyer when I see one, and too many officials, myself included, functioned as Israel's attorney, when in fact our client was an agreement, and we needed to lawyer for both sides. Now, my own colleagues, who I admire and respect, don't buy my argument. We weren't Israel's lawyer, they believe. We made a good faith effort commensurate with certain realities that exist in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. And I have to take that into account. No American president likes fighting with an Israeli prime minister. It's messy, it's awkward, it's distracting, it's politically costly. And it can be very counterproductive. So through the Clinton years and at Camp David, Bill Clinton was highly sensitive to not wanting, to use Clinton's word, jam, quote unquote, Ehud Barak. And that meant not jamming him, meant taking a position in the negotiations that the summit ran us, put it that we didn't run the summit ran us. I mentioned first Camp David. We controlled, the Carter administration controlled the text. It went through 23, 24 drafts. We would get Israeli-Egyptian comments. Some we'd take, some we wouldn't. But there was no text at Camp David, and we lost control, in my view, and I write about this, on the fourth day of the summit, we had prepared an INP paper. Laid out Israeli positions, Palestinian positions, with some possible bridging proposals. We sent it to the Israelis first. They hated it. They sent it back. We incorporated most of their changes. We then intended to send it to the Palestinians. But the fourth day of the summit, I saw the late Saab Erekat walking on one of those extraordinary pathways in the Catoctin Mountains. And he said, look, Aaron, where's the paper? You're supposed to give us an INP paper. I said, we're still working on it. And he looked at me and he smiled and laughed and said, you've given it to the Israelis first, haven't you? And, you know, what could I say? I laughed and walked away. Well, Saab was right. In the no surprise category, we shared everything with the Israelis. That's a problem. If we weren't prepared to make our own judgments of what constituted a reasonable basis for negotiation, which Clinton would later come to by the end of his term in December, the Clinton parameters, which was a pretty good run at trying to find that middle ground, which Barak accepted with reservations, which Arafat said yes to with reservations that went well outside of anything that were within the bounds of what we would have anticipated. So I guess I would say, because of the special relationship, because of the domestic politics, because of the sensitivity to Israeli security needs and requirements, we usually took a position, again, in the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, which were unique and different, right, admittedly, from the others, a state, established state, and a national movement seeking at times to negotiate, but also to fight and to acquiesce in terror, creates a whole new set of problems. There was no Jerusalem in the Israeli-Syrian negotiation. There was no Jerusalem in the Israeli-Egyptian negotiation. there was no press by the Israelis to get the Egyptians or Syrians or Jordanians to recognize Israel as the nation state of the Jews. There was a huge press on the part of whatever Israeli government we negotiated with on these issues, on that question. So, and of the right of return, the refugee issue, it wasn't about 1948, but it seemed to me, watching Israelis and Palestinians negotiate during the, in my judgment, the last best chance to solve this problem, which was in the 6 to 8 months of the Clinton administration, that Israelis and Palestinians were operating as if it were a 1948 problem. And maybe one of the reasons that we didn't get it was because, in fact, it was a 1948 problem. One of the smartest humans in this negotiation was my friend and colleague, John Schwartz, who was the State Department lawyer who worked with us on negotiations. John's bottom line was simply this: Aaron, we disrespected the issues. We really didn't understand how profoundly the sense of historical wounding, the sense of trauma, and how complex the issues of Jerusalem, borders, security, refugees, recognition of Israel as the nation state of the Jews, as Israel's identity issue, and end of all conflict and claims. There's a reason, David, that this conflict has defied resolution for so long. And I can accept all kinds of responsibilities for our role. And we can lambast the Palestinians all day long for their dysfunction and never missing an opportunity to miss an opportunity, all of it. And the violence on both sides. But at the end of the day, I have to ask myself a question as to whether or not on planet Earth there really is a way to resolve borders, security, refugees, Jerusalem, Israel's identity issue, which is the fear of being overwhelmed by Palestinian demography, and end of all conflict and claims, whether or not it's possible. Every other issue, water, settlements, all are subsumed under those six core issues. Whether or not it's really possible to do that, I still believe that it is possible, but I think we really did, as Americans, underestimate the degree of difficulty of the issues. And if you add American domestic politics and the sensibilities of American politicians and the emotional involvement, Clinton knew very little about Israel or the Israeli-Palestinian issue, unlike Joe Biden. Rabin handed this man a piece of history in Oslo, and I saw Clinton transformed. I saw him relate to Arafat in a way no other American president or any other American negotiators ever related to the Palestinians. But I saw him look at Rabin as if he were a father figure. I mean, Clinton grieved after Rabin's death in a way that was, he wrote in his memoirs, he loved Rabin as he had rarely loved any man.
But I want to just draw the lessons learned, because it seems like in your extended and nuanced recapitulation of U.S. diplomacy, there is between the lines a kind of damning indictment of the normative position, which is the abandonment of that stance of, let's call it, skillful broker, who is able to see sort of the virtues and liabilities of both sides. And very few American presidents, or for that matter, diplomats, have assumed that role. And this brings us to the present. And, your sense of A, whether the Biden administration is playing to form squarely within that tradition of not being the skillful broker, but tending more to the side of being Israel's lawyer, and B, whether the Biden administration, say, in its second term, has the potential to undertake whatever is necessary to somehow, together with actors like MBS, put Israeli-Palestinian negotiations on a different track, a track other than sort of the current paradigm of cyclical violence.
Right. I mean, you're making this too easy for me. I mean, the obvious answer is this one, and you raised it yourself. Any administration that conceives of ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a national interest, something that transcends partisan politics and is worth doing, and has individuals who know what they're doing, could actually do this. If in fact, and here's the kicker, obvious, the kicker, and you know where I'm going, if you have that sense of leadership and ownership, that's the real question. And that's why it's no surprise that even though Jimmy Carter chased after an Israeli-Palestinian deal when he first became president, it was only after Sadat's trip to Jerusalem and Begin's response that he was able to succeed. I don't care how good a negotiator Jimmy Carter was or his team. They would have never been able to do this without the raw material fashioned by these leaders. And the same applies, and again, I will assume mea culpas, 1,000 mea culpas for all the transgressions that I committed in citing, thinking first about Israeli needs and requirements, not balancing to the degree we should. And I tried a lot harder than others to do that. But without the buy-in of an Israeli and Palestinian willing to do this, no matter what we did, and no American president, David, is going to take this on to virtue signal. Barack Obama learned that by articulating a settlements freeze, which was a disaster, because he was not prepared to back it up with any cost or consequence. So, and governing is about choosing. Biden has a lot on his plate. So I would divide, again, time into two sets of increments. The first is the period between now and November, which I believe will be the year of Gaza. Messy, complicated, with an administration that if it wants buy-in from anybody, it's going to have to articulate some vision that Gaza first cannot be Gaza only. That doesn't mean it's going to apply itself in an election year to an intense effort, not just to identify the political horizon, but to identify a set of mutually reinforcing concrete steps that each side, Israel and the Palestinian Authority, can take that would create the right environment so you can actually have a negotiation. I don't believe the administration, they might even create such a roadmap. I do not believe, for political reasons, that this administration has any intention of getting into a huge fight that will ultimately fail and hurt the president politically in the process. And frankly, and I'll make an editorial comment here, and you know my view because I've said to many times, we've seen the enemy. And the enemy is not Vladimir Putin. It's not President Xi of China. It's not the Ayatollah. It's not Hamas. The American Republic confronts an enormous challenge in the next 10 months. In my judgment, if Joe Biden called me in and said, Aaron, I'm ready to launch, I know they're not ready, but I'm ready to launch a huge initiative. What do you think? I'd say, Mr. President, I voted for Democrats and even for Republicans. But the kind of Republicans that you're facing are not the kind of Republicans I ever worked for or I ever voted for. And your single greatest objective between now and November 2024 is to win re-election. And after that, I'd be more than happy to come in and have a meeting and share with you my views on what you should do. Because even if they're not ready, there may well be things that you can do that we must do in the wake of what's happened to make good on your commitment that you said last month that we cannot go back to October 6th. We cannot allow the situation to go back to October 6th.
Well, with that typically realist perspective on what path lies ahead for the United States, I want to thank you, Aaron David Miller, for making time to be with us on Then and Now. It's been really enlightening.
David, thank you, because it takes a really skilled moderator to do a really good conversation. And you are that, and I think we really have had a good conversation. I'm glad I could do it.
Thank you for listening to Then and Now, a podcast by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. You can learn more about our work or share your thoughts with us at our website, luskincenter.history.ucla.edu. Our show is produced by David Myers and Rosalind Campbell, with original music by Daniel Reichman. Special thanks to the UCLA History Department for its support, and thanks to you for listening.